Priscilla versus City of Bayonne, number 21-1504.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Vincent Gerbino. I'm here on behalf of the appellant plaintiff, Stacy Priscilla. And may it please the court, I wish to raise some points here in oral argument that are also contained in the brief, but things that I think need to be addressed more poignantly is that we believe the district court abused its discretion as it relates to the issue regarding the admissions. There were requests for admissions served. These requests went unanswered. There was never a motion for a protective order. There was never a motion to withdraw them. The admissions went unanswered. They should have been deemed admitted. The district court found that despite the fact that the requests were never admitted, were never responded to, that they should simply be ignored, that they don't apply, and found that they don't hold them to be conclusively establishing the matters that are contained in the admission.
So let me just ask you a question. As I understand the scope of a permissible request for admission, it can deem certain facts, maybe authenticity of documents, and even in some cases the application of law to facts or facts to law, depending on which order you like there. But if some of these admissions were just pure legal conclusions, the district court's under no obligation to accept those, is it?
I agree, Your Honor. But in this particular case, and I read the admissions fairly in depth, right?
Yeah,
there were several of them. Right. There were several of those admissions. There's over 70 listed, but inclusive in those 70 are admissions that relate to the actual event concerning the magnets being placed on this woman's desk, concerning the depiction of the women in inappropriate garb with offensive statements contained therein. A lot of those admissions related to that sexual harassment issue and whether or not Joseph Wax did that and whether or not they were in placed in the areas where Ms. Stacy indicated that they were, right? So a lot of those admissions go to the very heart of the actual harassment
itself. So you're saying they're actual factual. They aren't legal conclusions. Most of them you're saying are just factual, and so therefore because they were factual, they would be deemed admitted but for the district court's sua sponte action.
And I'm willing to agree that there were some in that admission that were more conclusory in nature, but not all of them. And certainly the bulk of them dealt with those issues regarding the cursing, the events, the magnet, the inappropriate nature of which was placed on Ms. Priscilla's desk. Those magnets were crucial to her claim. They were factual allegations. They were admitted, and Judge McNulty should have acknowledged that.
Mr. Gimeno, a prerequisite for the obligation to respond is, of course, that these were properly served. You indicated at the outset that they were served. But what we have in the record, I wonder if you could just explain. We have at Appendix 840, it looks like a Gmail that just says, "Dear Teresa, please see attached." And the RFAs are then attached to it. Was there service other than by what appears to be personal email? And to the extent that the local rules permit electronic service, it appears that they do so when there has been consent in writing. Is there any indication on this record of that consent?
Your Honor, I unfortunately took over the case later on down the road, well after this event had occurred. My understanding was, based upon what's in the brief, that it was properly served. That was never an issue that even McNulty brought up. So my understanding of that is that they were properly served. And even Judge McNulty indicated that it was a lapse on the part of the appellees to not respond. And then he just took it upon himself at his discretion to tossed them aside based upon the Sunoco decision, which I don't think really is applicable here, given the fact that this was a summary judgment level matter and not a pretrial.
But you've got no dispute if the district judge determined that there had been no consent to receive service of discovery requests via email, that if that was the basis for the decision, then the district judge would have been perfectly well-grounded in rejecting the conclusive effect of these RFAs.
If there was such an issue, I'm unaware of that, honestly, because I came into this matter much later than, it's been going on quite a while. So
we also have the test under Rule 36B as to what a district court should evaluate in the presence of a motion. You don't dispute that as to the factors to be considered, namely whether it promotes presentment of the merits or would prejudice your client, that those were things that the district court addressed.
Well, the district court had in front of it a motion for summary judgment, right? So the district court had, at that point in time, the obligation to look for material issues of fact. And I think the record here is replete with material issues of fact. The issue relating to the merits is to me, not yet applicable here. The motion for summary judgment under Rule 56 is, are there material issues of fact? And that was overlooked. And the judge abused his discretion in that regard and went beyond what the call was, what the duty was of the judge at that point in time, which was to determine if there were material issues of fact, which there were. And in terms of the prejudice issue on that second prong of that Sunoco test, had my client realized that these admissions were not going to be accepted by the court, she would have clearly have done further efforts in terms of discovery with respect to her co-workers, some of which are no longer available.
So the judge acknowledged the effect, regardless of the admission, go to the magnet issue. That's your requests 31 and 46. All that's being asked, one or two magnets, I agree, is a slight difference in the two requests for admissions. But did, in fact, Mr. Walks post a magnet? The judge acknowledged that the record said that he had.
Yes.
And his position was it simply wasn't material.
Well, but Your Honor, the first decision coming in November 9th of 2020, the judge found that there was enough for determining a hostile work environment on that very issue of the magnets. Then on motion for reconsideration, goes even further and decides, you know what, I'm changing my mind. The magnets are insignificant. How could the magnets be insignificant? They were all over the office with respect to demeaning a woman.
Over. Most of your client says is two. The judge thought there was one, but I
that
change my mind all the time.
Isn't incorrect. There were multiple magnets all about the office, and one directly planted on Ms. Priscilla's desk.
Okay, but that's not one of your requests for admissions.
The admissions do relate to the issue of the magnets and who they placed them and where they were. I also want to address the issue of the timeliness.
Not to let that go, I don't want to dwell on the magnets. What admission do you particularly point to or request that would have altered the outcome of the case in terms of summary judgment? And a lot of the requests for admissions have nothing to do with any claim presented to the court. Some are conclusions of law. What do I look at?
My viewing of the admissions, I thought number 24 related to the sexual harassment issue, number 28, number 31, number 32, the number 33, the retaliation issues, number 25 and 34, 38 again with sexual harassment and retaliation. So that's how I viewed them, Your Honor. And addressing the issue of the motion for reconsideration, after the judge finds that there is sufficient evidence of a hostile work environment, we move to have a reconsideration on the issue of admissions. Our reconsideration motion is timely. The appellee's reconsideration motion is not timely. It's beyond the local rule 7.1, well 14 days post when it would have been due. And the judge, again, ignores that, even though we indicate in our opposition that we found that reconsideration motion by the appellees was untimely. That is not addressed. And the last comments I just want to make is that at this time in this Rule 56 summary judgment motion, there was a clear indication of material issues of fact that the judge decided not to find, that the judge abused his discretion upon, becoming the arbiter of the facts when at that point in time, the reason we were there is to determine whether or not there are issues of material fact, not to get to a pretrial level, which is why I don't believe Sunoco is applicable here. That's the ultimate, you know, concern I have here, is that it was an abuse in terms of what was available on the record at that time, established enough evidence of material facts that needed to get to a jury. And Judge McNulty chose to ignore it. He chose to ignore the lapse in the admissions and essentially be the arbiter of the facts at that point in time when that wasn't his role.
We grant district judges a lot of latitude in the way they run their courtrooms and apply the rules. True, the rule requires or provides that the withdrawal be upon motion. But why would it be an abuse of discretion for the district court to consider that to allow for its own sua sponte motion? And alternatively, why couldn't a district court looking at a motion for summary judgment that takes issue with the facts in an RFA consider that a implied motion for withdrawal?
Yeah, I don't think that at this point in time, when the judge had this before him, right, you had a very clear violation of Rule 36B in that the admissions were presented, the admissions were not responded to. The judge himself used it as a lapse. And then in the November 9th decision, and this is what's troubling to me, is that in the November 9th decision, he does all of that, Your Honor, and finds that there's a hostile work environment issue to get to a jury. And then, and I can't get into the judge's mind, on the reconsideration issue, on the one issue relating to the admissions, goes even further and decides the case in its entirety. So I don't understand how there cannot be a material issue of fact when in one decision there was, and in the other there isn't. So that's where I can't understand why that was. It didn't make sense to me. In one breath, in November 9th, he finds there's an issue of fact as to this hostility that occurred to this woman. In the next breath, it's gone. Why is it gone? Clearly, there was a material issue of fact. He had decided that on November 9th. And that's my position on that.
But the district court itself indicated that that was because its initial ruling was based on a misunderstanding of the facts, right?
I can't imagine that. It was a 30-something page decision on the November 9th order, where he goes painstakingly through all the issues and finds that the magnets in and of themselves created the hostile work environment. So how could they be thrown out on the reconsideration motion? It just doesn't add up to me. And that's why I feel it should be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Nicholas Sullivan from Florio Perucci, Steinhardt, Capelli, Tipton, and Taylor on behalf of Appellee, City of Bayonne, Joseph Wax, and Richard Sansullo. I'd like to pick up from the beginning, speaking about the request for admissions. As this court is aware, based on my briefing, the district court properly relied on the Sunoco, Inc., R&M v. MX Wholesale Fuel Corp. Case, which Ms. Purcella has not provided any cases that refute the Sunoco case, nor have they tried to rebut the Sunoco case. And as a point of clarification, Sunoco was on summary judgment, and the issue being there was the case, the court sua sponte, like Judge McNulty, although at the same time on my opposition, I requested him to review the Sunoco case for the request for admissions after raised by plaintiff, I'm sorry, Ms. Priscilla at the time. But the Sunoco case, it boils down to the crux is the two-prong factor test, which is the moving party must establish that withdrawal or amendment will subserve the presentation on the merits, and second, whether the non-moving party will be prejudiced by permitting the moving party to amend or withdraw the admission.
Counsel, that only gets you so far. It's a district court decision. We're now at the point of looking at the rules and trying to ascertain what the proper interpretation of the rules was. Maybe the Sunoco court erred as well. It really depends on ultimately you know, what we're persuaded to understand of the requirements of the rule. So rather than pointing to the district court there, can you speak to us about how the rule should be interpreted and why, when it provides upon motion, and there was no motion here, that the court had properly exercised its authority under that rule?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So Rule 36 does permit under subsection B, or I'm sorry, it does permit that you may make a motion to waive or rescind the responses to requests for admissions. I believe it comes back to a public policy, which is well within our court, that it's better to solve a case or hear a case on the merits than on procedural deficiencies. So here I believe that it's the district court, but I believe the district court has applied it correctly, that it's on the merits, this case, based on the record, as Judge McNulty argued at length, as Mr. Gribino mentioned in his two very lengthy opinions, the record contradicts the request for admissions. And the request for admissions goes to not just the facts of this case, they also contradict the record itself. Request 30 seeks an admission that plaintiff had no disciplinary history prior to 2012. Well, if that was admitted, that would be a lie, because Priscilla was served with a 31A form on November 9th for improperly notarizing a document and was suspended 60 days in 2011 for confiscating employee personnel documents.
Request for admission get to what will be disputed in a given case.
Right.
And so it may be that for purposes of this case, we often see a lot of lawyers writing, we see Congress writing for purposes of this subsection, and you see a lot of people saying for purposes of. And so maybe this could be admitted just for purposes of this case, and these admissions do supersede pleadings. Admissions quite commonly can be superseding of pleadings. But let me ask you this. Rule 36 has a fee-shifting provision. And the fee-shifting provision says, basically, I'm paraphrasing, if someone denies a request for admission and then turns out to prove that admission to be true, the other side has exposure for the attorney's fees that were incurred in that proof. Now, I think it's still discretionary, but there's a tilt to the way that rule goes. And doesn't that fear of fee shifting justify why it has to be on motion? Because if a court says, I now no longer view these as admitted, I view these as in essence denied, hasn't the court sua sponte created exposure to your client for attorney's fees for any proof that would come that would validate any one of these admissions? And doesn't that show us why we can't let that decision be in the hands of a court? If a party wants to set something aside, they incur with that the risk and the exposure that they may be liable for fees if that's later, if their denial is later proved untrue.
Well, I do agree that I believe it's discretionary to begin with one point you made. But second, I agree that on its face, a motion would be preferable. But here, I take it back to this was basically to be on the merits. If not, this is a procedural issue that Priscilla would be permitted to move forward past summary judgment based on facts that could be deemed admitted that aren't true. So the record wholly contradicts them. Additionally, as I've argued, the plaintiff or Priscilla perceived no prejudice because a lot of the requests for admissions were directly out of the complaint, which were all denied by the answer by the party. So No, I don't think in this instance it opens it up for exposure because this is slightly different than if this was at some point during and I was able to first deny it and then I needed to admit a fact, I would have to file a motion later. I think it's different because this was based on, one, judicial expediency, and two, to have a decision on the merit instead of a procedural deficiency.
Judge Stearns?
Yeah, our job really is not so much the number of magnets as to give guidance and interpretation of the rule itself. Wouldn't it be a better practice for a district court judge who did what the judge did here to announce in advance? It's just that he intended on his own motion to consider or deem the requests withdrawn and then invite the parties to respond.
He could have done that, Your Honor. I would believe it was his discretion at that point. I do say it wasn't a surprise to Ms. Purcella, as I did make this argument, and she was allowed to respond because she filed a deficient cross motion for summary judgment and filed a reply, if I recall correctly, to that. So she had the opportunity to be heard on this instance. She chose not to address this except to say that they are admitted and that's where the court's inquiry should end, which I don't agree with based on my briefing and Judge McNulty's decision, which I fully support.
Why isn't that par for the course if a party decides not to respond to request for admission and not to move for withdrawal? And that's a choice that a party could make. Why shouldn't they be held to that and the district court stay within the four corners of the rule?
No, fair question, Your Honor. I think my argument would be that this, I could have moved for this within the summary judgment motion, though. So I think it's okay at that time that Judge McNulty took it sua sponte or based on my suggestion, because I brought this case to his attention, that the request for admissions should be, the appellees should be released from the request for admissions at that point. So, I think this is a unique situation. I don't think this is one that applies across the board. But I think when it comes to a public policy of this case has a record that demonstrated that the request for admissions, if deemed admitted, would be wholly contrary to the record, that this was necessary. And at the same time, a motion could have been filed in conjunction with the summary judgment at that time.
When you say you brought this to the court's attention, you mean you asked the district court to withdraw the admissions?
So as I recall it, Your Honor, I filed summary judgment in this case. Purcella responded and raised the issue of the request for admissions. At the time, I responded to that, asking the court to apply the Sunoco two-part test, which the court took under advisement, and Judge McNulty went through that analysis. That's my recollection.
Is that in the record anywhere?
I should be in my opposition brief, or I'm sorry, my reply brief to summary judgment.
Worth looking into.
Thank you.
Yes. I will just add for one more thing. When it comes to the cross motion for reconsideration, that the local rules, the way they can be read, is that 7.1H says a cross motion related to the subject matter of the original motion may be filed by the party opposing the motion together with that party's opposition, in pertinent part. 7.1, which follows 7.1H, 7.1I, speaks about reconsideration. So I believe it is in the discretion of the district court, which is given latitude to interpret its own local rules, for Judge McNulty to accept a cross motion for reconsideration, as he explained in his opinion. And I did cite to another case, which was another district court case, which he didn't give much weight to, but that was a LW versus Jersey City Board of Education case where the same incident happened. There was a reconsideration and another cross motion more than 14 days later, and the district court at that time heard it on the merits. So although that case is not precedential or have any bearing on this court, I do believe the district court has done this before, so this is not an unusual practice.
So just for the sake of completeness, in addition to the briefing on summary judgment, was there also argument, and was there a transcript of that argument prepared?
There was no oral argument before the district court. It was done on the papers.
And when this issue arose that prompted you to raise Sunoco with the district court, why not simply file a motion to withdraw?
It's a fair question, Your Honor. I want to say, as mentioned, this was not my case to begin with, which is not an excuse, but this was not something I had knowledge of until that time. So I just asked the court to do it that way without filing a notice of motion based on the arguments presented by Purcell.
If the court were to have said that they construed your reply brief as sufficient for a motion, then we would be in complete conformity with the rule, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Drew Krause, Jason Lamparillo, Malin Capuzzo, for the defendant, Richard Sensulo. I'm involved in this matter on a very limited basis with respect to count D of plaintiff's complaint and any claim that was lodged for punitive damages against Mr. Sensulo. And just to point out to the court, our position, of course, is that although plaintiff would characterize this, or the appellant would characterize this case as a discrimination case against Mr. Sensulo, that particular count lodged against him is one for intentional interference with contract. So our position with that, with respect to that, and again, initially there was a complaint filed, I believe, in 2014 in June with certain claims against Mr. Sensulo that might have dealt with the law against discrimination and harassment claims. However, the plaintiff affirmatively removed those claims about 4 months later and only lodged an intentional interference with contract claim against Mr. Sensulo. And our position in front of the district court was that there is no contract involved here with Ms. Purcella that plaintiff has, or that the appellant has pointed to, because she was a civil service employee with Bayonne, and as such, her employment was governed by the civil service rules and regulations under Title 4A of the New Jersey Administrative Code. So plaintiff, in the allegations in her complaint from October of 2014, nearly 8 years ago, has indicated that the contract she's referring to lies in the employment handbook of Bayonne. However, I think in our briefing we dispelled the fact that handbook cannot serve as an employment contract because there was a clear disclaimer in there, and under the New Jersey case law, Woolley and progeny, that disclaimer dispels any notion that was an employment contract in her favor. So in this case, because she has never presented an employment contract that could have actually been interfered with by Mr. Sensulo, that her claims cannot lie under count D of the amended complaint.
Was there a collective bargaining agreement as well?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did ESME also have a collective bargaining interest in city employees?
I believe there was a collective bargaining agreement, but that has never been presented to us.
Well, it was referred to briefly in the papers, but I assume your argument would be that that's for the benefit of the union, she's not an intended third-party beneficiary in a pure contract sense.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Your Honor. Yes, that is a union contract for the benefit of the union in total, and it's not unique to the appellant. So based on what was before the district court, or I should say what was not before the district court in terms of a contract that could support that claim that was lodged, the district court correctly ruled that claim could not be sustained. And to piggyback off of that, there was a claim for punitive damages. Not only do we believe that was not pled properly, but we don't believe that claim could be sustained either, because if the underlying claim for breach or intentional interference with contract couldn't be proven, it couldn't be used to support punitive damages in this case. Putting that aside, I think on the record, I don't think there's sufficient evidence against Mr. Sensulo to support any punitive damages claims in terms of willful and wanton conduct or any sort of actual malice that might have been demonstrated by him with respect to anything that occurred with respect to the appellant in this matter. So based on that, we believe, or I believe, at least with respect to count D and punitive damages, that the district court ruled properly in dismissing those claims on summary judgment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly, in terms of the issues associated with Mr. Consulo, this was a gentleman who was coming into the city of Bayonne on a regular basis because he was contracted to be the head of the Department of Health. And various times when he would be there, he would refer to my client in derogatory ways, chesty or whatever, you know, he could come up with at the time. Moments within days, not even many days, I think it was 2 days, after she acknowledged or reported this to her EEO officer, she's removed. Mr. Consulo had a lot of power in the city, and he was able to make a few calls, make a few statements, and she was removed. And she was a 16-year employee at her location. She was then removed. The union has a collective bargaining agreement. The union, in my position in that regard, Your Honor, is that it is a contract, and it's a contract that protects the people, members of the union, of which this Ms. Purcell was. So by enforcing his power, he was able to have his efforts succeed in retaliating against hers. That was the breach of the contract. That was the breach, and it affected her job, it affected her position. And this was a long-term zealous employee for the city of Bayonne.
The union never filed a grievance, though, did it?
Excuse me?
The union never pursued a grievance.
Not the union. She did. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all.
All right. We thank counsel for their argument today. We appreciate your time and helpful briefing. And we will take